Hello, this is Randy Thompson from the North Carolina Reading Service. Welcome to Music Review. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind or print impaired. For the next half hour, I shall be reading articles about music from such sources as the New York Times, the News and Observer, the Week Magazine, Rolling Stone, and Entertainment Weekly. Music Review is underwritten by Bill McClure, tuning pianos in the Raleigh area since 1968. For more information or to schedule a piano tuning appointment, please call 919-779-1755. This program is designed to provide the latest coverage of classical, folk, jazz, blues, rock, country, and pop music news. But first, these musical trivia questions. Today's trivia questions come to us from the website onthisday.com. Question number one, it was on this day in which year that RCA Victor announced that it would manufacture long playing LP records? Was it A, 1920, B, 1935, C, 1950, or D, 1965? LP records, which year was that anyway? And question number two, Sonny Bono, a famous singer and politician, died on this day back in 1998. What was that death the result of? A skiing accident? Is that true or false? So did Sonny of Sonny and Cher singing duo die from a skiing accident? The answers to these two important trivia questions will be given, as usual, at the end of today's program. Our transitions come to us from that same website, onthisday.com, and today, quote-unquote, is the weekend of January the 3rd, 2025. This is the first program of the new year, 2025. Well, it was 60 years ago today, 1965, that Leo Fender sold the Fender Guitar Company to CBS for $13 million. And that was 1965 today. And it was on this very day, back in 1959, that Buddy Holly released the Paul Anka Penn song, It Doesn't Matter Anymore, which would be Holly's final single, because Holly died a few weeks later, along with Ritchie Valens and the Big Bopper, J.P. Richardson, in a tragic plane crash following their show at the Surf Ballroom in Clear Lake, Iowa. Waylon Jennings, by the way, was supposed to be on that same flight, but the Big Bopper traded places with him at the last minute. Holly's last tune released today in 59. Dvorak's Songs My Mother Taught Me introduces our classical music news. It's titled, Has Streaming Damaged Our Knowledge of Classical Music? Before classical streaming, the seven ages of recorded music, from 78 RPMs to MP3s. This is published in BBC Music Magazine, 28 November 2024, by Richard Morrison. Like Jacques in Shakespeare's As You Like It, I divide my life into seven ages. Unlike Jacques, I define those ages by the ways in which recorded music entered my life. The first age, back in the late 1950s, was when I became aware of my dad's prized collection of 78 RPM discs. As thick as dinner plates, they required you to leap from your chair every 4 minutes to turn the disc over or start the next one. Listening to Handel's Messiah, my dad maintained, was a great way to keep fit. He had Malcolm Sargent's recording on 19 separate 78s. You leapt up 38 times if you wanted a complete performance. And the other six ages? LPs arrived in our living room in the early 1960s, followed by 45 RPMs, singles, during my teenage love affair with what was then called the Hit Parade. After that, I consumed recorded music via cassettes, CDs, MP3s, and now almost entirely by streaming, a medium which I guess may outlive me. Classical streaming, so very convenient and space effective. Obviously, the gain in convenience has been extraordinary. From leaping up 38 times to listen to Messiah, I can now access 38 different interpretations simply by scrolling down a list on my phone. Just as dramatic has been the gain in shelf space. When I was 30, my LP collection occupied an entire wall of a bedroom. Now my weird need to have a recording of every Haydn symphony within reaching distance is a naughty secret between me and my computer, freeing up that vital bedroom space for my wife's essential collection of exercise bikes and running machines. Classical streaming, adrift from a world of scholarship. So that's all gain, but there's been a loss, too. Those wonderful LPs I collected in the 1970s came with extraordinary erudite sleeve notes. At a time when historical authenticity was becoming a big thing in Renaissance and Baroque performance, up-to-date scholarship was presented almost as an add-on bonus when you bought the latest Hogwood or Harmoncourt recording. But as recording formats became smaller, the accompanying information packs also shrank or disappeared altogether. Well, yes, you could argue, as record company execs and their champions in the press often did, that such information was by this time readily available through Wikipedia and other online encyclopedias. But how many first-time listeners went down that route? To make matters worse, the trend towards minimizing or dispensing with sleeve notes and booklets coincided with the closure of specialist record shops and record libraries, staffed by people who could advise knowledgeably, and the decline of music teaching in schools. It's good news, then, that one leading classical music streaming site, Apple Music Classical, has just added 50,000 digital album booklets to its website. Of course, the reality is that classical music is increasingly being consumed track by track, especially by the young and others who are exploring the classical repertoire for the first time. But you hope that newcomers then move on to discovering whole symphonies, whole operas, in other words, whole albums. And that's when the listening experience can be deepened by album booklets. Does too much information put off newcomers? If you have some grasp of the historical, political, literary, and geographical context in which the music was written, and the intellectual process guiding the composer, your understanding will be much enriched. I speak from humble experience. I'm still learning from the program and album notes written by inspiring specialists. And as I stagger through my seventh recording age, that's saying something. Thank you. Gershwin's Rhapsody in Blue with Concerto in F. Newell Oler on piano introduces our jazz and blues music news with a mix of classical. It's titled John Batiste Finds the Blues in Beethoven. This is published by Terry Gross in NPR on the 9th of December, 2024. When it comes to revisiting older works, musicians have a golden opportunity, says John Batiste. You can connect dots that were never connected before. That's what Batiste is doing in his new album, Beethoven Blues, in which he reimagines Beethoven's compositions. Beethoven's work taps into a universal connective magnetic truth in music, Batiste explains, that you also hear in blues. It's like things that make you cry every time you hear them, things that make you dance every time you hear them. It's just something in the DNA of that song. Batiste was the band leader and music director of The Late Show with Stephen Colbert until 2022. He attended the Juilliard School and is now on its board. His Grammy nominations and wins span a wide range of categories, including jazz, American roots, contemporary classical, R&B, New Age, contemporary instrumental, and more. He is currently nominated for 2 Grammys for his documentary, American Symphony. This film is about composing his American Symphony and performing the premiere in Carnegie Hall in 2022. The film also documented the period when his now wife, writer Saleika Joad, was diagnosed with a recurrence of leukemia, which had been in remission. Batiste believes that classical music is ripe for transformation, Beethoven included. There's a sense of this rigid exactness to the score and this over-reverence of classical music, Batiste says. Artists should embrace the opportunity to remix it, to update it. Not that the original wasn't great and transcendent, but there's also a lot of things since then that have happened. And for us to connect those dots is one of the great things that we're able to do. Interview highlights. On beginning his album with Für Elise, it's something that brings people together around the piano. It's that thing that if you're at a party and you had a piano lesson once or twice in your life and you're having fun that night, you might go and play. Or somebody plays it and it's just so ubiquitous. It connects to something that is rare for us to have, all of us in our collective memory, a song, a melody, a theme like that. It's one of the first things that I learned, and then I had this habit of being in conversation with the composer. And once I learned something, changing things, adding themes, adding chords, and really making it my own in that way. On his trouble fitting in at the Juilliard School. I was just a very, very ambitious, precocious teenager in New York from Louisiana. I felt like I could go out and put bands together. I'd get dancers and actors and musicians, and we would go down into the subways and we'd play for folks. I just don't think at that time they could understand the bigger vision that I saw in my head. So things started to get to a point where they felt I wasn't focused enough. I had a fairly easy time with some of the assignments, and I would basically sometimes sit in class hearing music in my head, and I'd sing out loud. And then they would think, well, what's wrong with this guy? And he's got this melodica, and he's carrying around, and he's doing all of these zany projects. I got to the point where the things I was doing outside of school, I was touring and I was playing shows, and I was coming in and I was doing the work, but I also was not following the pattern of the ideal student. And it became a question of, is my ambition going to pull me out of the school before they kick me out of school? And they wanted me to make that choice. So it was just one of those periods of time where you learn how to prioritize your life and how to balance your life. And you also learn that you got to stick to your guns because maybe nobody sees it yet but you. And that doesn't mean it's not true. On returning to Juilliard, my dad is my first musical mentor, and he's someone who, through his experience playing on the Chitlin circuit and just his stories of traveling, he'd always wished that he could go to a school like Juilliard. So it was for the legacy of my family. Now fast forward, I'm on the board, and I'm helping to change the place for folks who come in there like me, who are maybe not the typical conservatory musician student. On experiencing success in his career at a time when his wife was very sick. There's a deep sense of connectivity that you have with your soulmate. When you're on television, when you're accepting an award that everyone in the world is telling you you should want more than anything else, you have this feeling in the back of your mind, in your heart, that I could lose my soulmate at any moment. That is a pressure like none other, and that is a force that ransacks your psyche in a way that I didn't realize the power of creativity as an antidote until then. And through our shared creativity, there was a lot of light that we created together and apart from each other. I sent her lullabies. She would paint. She couldn't write. Her vision was blurred from all the medication. And she's this incredible, renowned writer, but she couldn't write, so she began to paint. And just that practice alone was a form of transformative healing power and light. It gave me the motivation to be able to leave her because I didn't want to leave her side. It's funny to say going to a Grammy ceremony where you're nominated 11 times is work, but it puts things in perspective when you're that close to losing this person in your life. But for me, at that time, creativity was the power that allowed for us to stay connected and for me to have the will to go out and do all the things that you saw me doing at that time. On his joyful public persona, I think that I'm associated with joy because I do it to a level that is hard to come by. I do it well, and it's not something that you see often. In particular, when you think of performers who are in the mainstream, I think it's very important to have joy in your expression, in the expression of artists across all cultures. Joy is something that continues to transcend and stand the test of time. But I also think that there's always been this underpinning in my music that's coming from struggle and coming from many things that maybe transmute into joy later, but don't start that way. On the theme in American Symphony. That's one example of something that certainly leads to joy, but comes from deep, deep pain and an unresolved duress that our country is founded upon, and many of the things that we are in debate on or around. The culture clashes of our time and the shift that is occurring right before our eyes in our time, and really just thinking about a theme that cuts through all of that and really speaks to it at the same time. This melody, it could be a chant, it could be a prayer, it can be a hymn, it can be a war cry. So how'd you do on today's trivia questions? Well, the answer to our first question, it was on this very day in which year that RCA Victor announced that it would manufacture a long playing LP records. Was that A, 1920, B, 1935, C, 1950, or D, 1965? Correct answer, as reported by onthisday.com, is answer C, 1950. And as noted in HiFiPlus.com, for the audio aficionado and laterally anyone else, the LP record is one of the most iconic music formats of all time. Without it, the course of reproduced music would have been very different indeed, although it's hard to predict what course it would have taken. One alternative that ran in parallel was the magnetic tape recorder, a technology developed shortly after the shellac record. The first tape recorders were made by AEG, Germany, in 1934. But tape wasn't to become a commercial reality until 1948, when Ampex introduced its first recorder, the Ampex 200, in the United States. Coincidentally, it was just about the same time that the LP, or long playing record, was invented by Peter Goldmark at Columbia Records. It was a good year for developments in audio reproduction. Columbia introduced the use of vinyl and 33 and a third RPM, revolutions per minute, that became the accepted speed for LPs. This gave a playing time of up to 22 minutes per side. This was a major increase on the 5-minute total from 78 RPM 10-inch shellac discs that were released shortly after the turn of the century by the Victor Company. And the answer to our second question, Sonny Bono, a famous singer and politician, died on this day back in 1998. Was that the result of a skiing accident? True or false? Correct answer is answer A, that's true. As noted in an article by Fred Frommer in Britannica.com, Sonny Bono was born in Detroit to immigrants from Sicily. The family struggled financially, and when he was 7 years old, they moved to Los Angeles. He later dropped out of high school and worked odd jobs, including those of a truck driver, construction worker, and waiter. During this time, he was also writing songs, and one of his first singles, Coco Joe, spelled with K's, was later performed by the Righteous Brothers. In the late 1950s, Bono began working at Specialty Records, a label that featured such performers as Little Richard and Sam Cooke. Bono served as a writer and producer before the label closed in 1960. Several years later, he joined Gold Star Studios, and there he became the protege of Phil Spector, a hugely influential record producer. In 1963, Bono met a 16-year-old girl named Sherilyn Sarkisian, who went by the name Cher. Bono was 27 at the time. Cher was smitten and said in 2018, "He was the most unusual person I'd ever seen. He had longish hair, he had the most beautiful suit on, and beautifully long fingers and beetle boots, but they were Cuban heels." Cher eventually moved in with Bono, and their relationship, platonic at first, later became romantic. After an unofficial ceremony in 1964, the couple wed in 1969. The couple shared an interest in music, and Sonny introduced Cher to Spector, who had her sing backup on several songs he produced, including Be My Baby, 1963, by the Ronettes. Sonny and Cher also began recording music together, and in 1965 they had their first major hit, I Got You, Babe, which was written by Sonny. The pop single sold more than 1 million copies, and it made Sonny and Cher famous. He subsequently wrote a series of popular songs that included The Beat Goes On, 1967. In 1985, Bono opened an Italian restaurant in Palm Springs, California, called Bono's. His efforts to hang a business sign were met with red tape, and the experience inspired him to enter politics. In 1988, Bono, who had not voted until he was 53 years old, won the mayoral race in Palm Springs, and in 1992, he ran for the U.S. Senate. He lost in that Republican primary. Bono subsequently set his sights on the U.S. House of Representatives. In the 1994 midterms, Bono was elected to represent the state's 44th congressional district. Bono brought star power to Washington, D.C., and he became one of the most popular Republican public speakers. He had a self-deprecating style, once observing, "I feel kind of like the black sheep in Congress, but here I am." And he noted that people often underestimated him. He quickly won over key Capitol Hill players with a humorous speech at a Washington Press Club Foundation dinner in 1995. Bono said that he did not deliver speeches from prepared remarks after trying it once and failing miserably. On January 5, 1998, during a skiing trip, Bono crashed into a tree at the Heavenly Ski Resort on the California-Nevada line and died of massive head injuries. So let's close out today's program with Sonny and Cher's "I Got You, Babe." Well, we've run out of time for today's episode of Music Review. Be sure to tune in at the same time next week. This program's also available as a podcast after the broadcast in our website, ncreadingservice.org. As we leave you now, remember these words: kindness is a language which blind people see and deaf people hear. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind or print impaired. If you have a suggestion for music to feature on this program, please leave a message for me at 919-832-5138. I'm Randy Thompson, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. Music Review, underwritten by Bill McClure, tuning pianos in the Raleigh area since 1968. For more information or to schedule a piano tuning, please call 919-779-1755. So long, until next time.
Then put your little hand in mine.